Welcome to another fantastic ISI flyby show. Like most of us, you have probably wondered, where are robotics going? We already have robot lawnmowers and vacuums, as well as a few designed for social purposes in care homes and hospitals. But is that the whole story? Will we ever get a walking, talking humanoid robot to help us with the housework, for example? Well, today we'll be speaking to Dr. James Hilder, a senior research engineer at the University of York in England, and is soon to be affiliated with a new building called the Institute for Safe Autonomy. The name of the institute is certainly intriguing and somehow reassuring. I mean, we've all seen the sci-fi films of out-of-control robots and cyborgs, so knowing that someone is researching safe robots is encouraging to say the least. James will be talking to us about semi-autonomous and autonomous machines, and the problems that robotics experts face in making them both effective and safe to use. He's also a big supporter of young people getting involved, and we'll be asking him about some of the entry routes through software, like BBC Microbit, Arduino, and Raspberry Pi. So, let's get started. All right, so James, thank you so much for joining us today. And of course, well, the main question we've got to ask first is, what exactly defines a robot?
It's a good question. So the way I've always seen, always thought of what defines a robot is there's three core parts. So a robot's got to have sensors. It's got to have some way of sensing its environment, of being able to detect things in its environment. And then it's got to have actuators, which is some way of responding to the things it senses in its environment. So an actuator, most simple sort of actuator we would think of would be a motor, which might be attached to a wheel, but we can also have other things, such as we can have lights, LEDs, we can have things that create sound. And the third part would be we have to have something that essentially is the robot's brain, so something that can run a program. So it's usually a computer or a microcontroller embedded within the robot. I think once you have those three things, that sort of fits what I like to loosely define as a robot. But that does also then raise some interesting questions, because you've then got the argument that, well, if something, for example, a washing machine, modern washing machine, can sense the environment, it can weigh how much clothes are in there, and it can run a program, and it has actuators in it. It spins right. the washing machine and it pumps in water. So you then have the question, well, is a washing machine a robot? And I think a lot of people would think a washing machine probably doesn't fall into the category of robot, but it does still fit those terms. So it's an interesting question.
So that would be what a washing machine would be, an automated machine. So what would make a washing machine semi-autonomous?
I think if we dig deeper into washing machines, if you imagine back in the washing machines that we would have maybe 20, 30 years ago, they tend to have a mechanical program. So basically you put your clothes in, and they run a very simple state machine that goes through a step of different processes. It turns on the water pumps, it turns on the motors for a certain amount of time, and then it stops, and it might spin the motors the other way or spin a bit faster. If you think about how they've changed in the last few years, they've started adding things to washing machines, such as temperature sensors and weight sensors. So the washing machine now, when you put your clothes in, it'll weigh how many clothes are in, and then work out how long it needs to turn on the water valves to limit the amount of water that comes in. So it is already taking on extra steps to take it away from just a really simple state machine to something with a bit more autonomy, something that can think a bit more about what it's doing and perhaps do it in a slightly better way, so it can complete a task with a bit more sense behind it.
So if you could scale that up to a car, say, what would a semi-autonomous car be?
If you think of many of the cars that we're getting now, they're beginning to add a lot of extra driving features. I'm thinking things such as lane assist. So I don't know if being in a modern car, quite often now they'll have something that like shake the steering wheel or make a noise when it detects that the car might be crossing over a white line.
Yeah.
But it still very much is reliant on the driver being in control, and it's there as an assistant to the driver.
Can be very annoying as well.
It can be annoying, but of course, I suppose it could also potentially be a lifesaver.
Yeah, it could.
In the right circumstance. But obviously, the plan with cars is that the companies would like to add more and more of these autonomous features to them to eventually get us to a state where the driver either has no control in the car at all or a very limited amount of control, just a sort of last gasp emergency control.
Yeah.
So it's not a binary thing. It's a process where we add more and more autonomy as time goes on. But I think what we find is that these last steps towards full autonomy, towards full self-driving cars, become really, really tricky. There's either problems that we thought would be simple to solve, or there's many problems related to the fact that when you're in a road and you don't just have autonomous vehicles, where you've got this mix of people driving cars and autonomous vehicles, that gets really complicated because the autonomous vehicle has to be able to think how the human driver is going to respond.
Yes,
right.
Not respond. And vice versa, of course. The human driver has to, realise that they're not dealing with other human drivers now. So if you think about some of the almost social decision-making you have to do when you're driving. So I'm thinking things like if you come to a mini roundabout and all three vehicles arrive at the same time at a mini roundabout, obviously there's this, usually there's a very subtle human process that takes place where people will look at each other, they'll make eye contact, little subtle things. So people know who's going to pull out. That gets really tricky, I think, if you then have autonomous agents in there.
Yeah, because I mean, I think that's a really good example. Three drivers coming up to a mini roundabout. The social contact is eye contact, maybe waving a hand, maybe sort of a nod of the head or whatever. And a robot car can't do that. How would three robot cars deal with that?
It's a very good question. I think quite often what you may have is you may either subtly change the rules of the road or you'd have rules that basically say, one fundamentally does arrive first, doesn't it? So yes. You could say that in that situation, there is one that will be able to identify, well, I was the first robot here, or the other two would identify that robot was here first. And then perhaps the rules would say that one gets priority. But yeah, it's a really tricky problem.
Yeah.
That's why we're still quite a long way, I think, off fully autonomous vehicles. And I think we will be.
So this is the sort of problem that Tesla are having at the moment, isn't it? The problem of robot cars existing with human drivers and in different circumstances.
Yeah, very much. Tesla are certainly, I think, the company at the forefront of trying to really get autonomous car vehicles into the mainstay as being, replacing driver vehicles. And yes, they are finding that the last steps to a really tricky.
Yeah. I mean, just to make this obvious, I mean, one of the things that we've all grown up with is the concept of a robot being completely autonomous. That is, it decides when it wants to start work, when it has to do something, it decides how it's going to do it, and then it gets on with it. Now, at the moment, I mean, I've got a robot lawnmower. Mm-hmm. But it's not autonomous because I have to tell it when to start work. But once it does start work, it's pretty autonomous. It can go and decide where it's going to mow first and how it's going to mow it. And then it's got sensors to say whether the grass is long or whatever. When do you think we'll start to get fully autonomous robots in our homes, say?
I think if we're looking at things like lawnmowers, we're probably very close to that. Because if we're just saying, well, that last extra step is the robot having to decide, right now I need to cut the grass. We're probably at a position where we almost could do that. And we know how long it takes grass to grow. So the robot could itself have an idea of, now we need to act upon this. However, I don't think we'll get into a position where we're completely removing humans from the loop. I think, for example, there will be circumstances where that robot will come into a situation that it either can't identify or it's concerned about what's going on. Maybe a pet gets into its path and confuses it, or something goes wrong with one of its sensors, and that'll still then rely back on the human to either intervene, maybe to move the robot back to its base or to reset it, much as we still have these problems with computers. So again, I don't think it's something that I don't think it's binary. I think we'll just gradually move more and more to this, having ever greater levels of autonomy in the robots like that we use. And I think that is happening as we speak. And, you know, I'm sure the robot vacuum cleaners, lawnmowers in 10 years' time will be that bit more sophisticated than the ones now, and perhaps that bit more tolerant to unusual situations. You know, they may have extra sensors to detect when the weather turns bad and return to base or things like that.
So in terms of modern robotics, I'm sure that there'll be some kind of factor that prevents us from advancing in the way that we want to. Would that be down to the software, so the coding aspects, or is it down to the technological element of the hardware involved in the robotics?
I think very much both. If we start with the hardware, hardware's moved obviously phenomenally in the last 30, 40 years. We can still, Moore's law that basically states that the number of transistors on a chip will double every 18 to 24 months, that's right. Still essentially almost applies. So we're still getting computer chips coming out. We know that in a couple of years, there'll be computer chips with close to twice the amount of transistors that we have at the moment. And that therefore means close to twice the amount of compute capability. And what that means is that the algorithms that do things such as detect faces, detect natural speech, they'll get both better, more efficient, more accurate at what they're doing. However, there's still a big gap between those capabilities as they are at the moment and for example, how the human brain, the scale of the human brain. So the neural networks that we're building at the moment, these building blocks that let us do those sort of algorithms, they're still of the scale of a mouse's brain maybe. And so they're getting bigger, but we're still a few years off them being so vast that they can perhaps outperform a human at certain tasks, such as detecting, identifying different people or working out all the elements of a scene. However, likewise, there is a huge amount of work still needs to be done on the software side, a huge amount of work. And that's tricky. It's really tricky, the software side. Because we've kind of moved from a period where, maybe 30 years ago, most of our robots essentially acted as what we call a state machine, where they just essentially run through a program, a series of steps, which is fine for relatively simple tasks, but what we're expecting or hoping robots of the future to do is massively more complicated than that, and there's all sorts of different factors to take into place. There's all sorts of different systems interacting with each other, and having the software systems that can deal with all these interactions and be made safe and reliable is really tricky. So certainly, if we're looking at something like a self-driving car, I think the hardware is probably actually accelerating at a faster pace than the software.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Personal opinion. I think there's actually more work to do in both developing these algorithms, developing these systems, and proving that they're safe.
Okay. So is there a particularly difficult element when it comes to software regarding autonomy?
One of the trickiest things is dealing with edge cases. So usually when we think of something like a self-driving car, we can do sort of 90% of what we want it to do fine. So, we can make algorithms that'll make it stay in the center of the road. We can make algorithms that'll make it work out what the correct thing to do when it gets to a traffic light is. But then it's what to do when we have occurrences that we either haven't planned for or issues with sensors that we haven't planned for. And there are so many examples of this. Some smalls off the top of my head. For example, I think the Tesla sensors recently, in certain lighting conditions at a certain time of day, they would see a red traffic light as the moon. No, sorry, the other way around. They would see the moon as a red traffic light.
Right.
So you'd be driving along and the moon, full moon would be in front of you, and it would identify that as a red traffic light.
Oh, goodness.
And that then, of course, causes all sorts of problems because the car is, am I currently facing a traffic light or am I not? This gets confused as well because the car's kind of relying on its built-in map based on its GPS data, which would say there isn't a traffic light there. But of course, it gets really complicated because what's the correct action when part of you thinks you see a traffic light, part of you thinks you don't? Which one do you rely on to be the correct information and what would be the correct course of action? Because obviously, if you're just driving along at 60 miles an hour and suddenly you think there's a red traffic light in front of you, do you try and slam on the brakes? Very tricky problem. And this sort of thing happens. You know, there's all sorts of examples like this, which basically make the task of autonomous driving, I think, particularly challenging.
Yeah, because the real world is infinitely variable, isn't it? And accidents can happen, weather happens, trees fall down, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So any autonomous system has to be able to deal with all of that and intelligently.
And it's particularly tricky in a road, like I say, because usually I think, you know, if we're in a building, if we're dealing with a lab robot and it yeah. comes across a situation such as that, where it's like, I don't understand what's going on. Generally speaking, you can stop the robot, pause it, make it stay in its place, and then assess the situation afterwards. Perhaps you could yeah. revise your code, look at adding that edge case to it. It's tricky, though, if we're in the real world of a driving vehicle and that happens, because then, you know, how do we change code that already exists on all these cars in circulation?
Right.
So, yeah, really, really tricky problem.
So you could get... Sorry, go on.
Well, it's do we send an over-the-air update to the vehicles? So things like Tesla at the moment obviously can. They do receive over-the-air updates.
Yeah.
But as I'm sure you know, not sometimes we'll send an update to a computer or something and something goes wrong. Mm. Or something in their testing hasn't taken into account some situation that can then cause problems in that computer or that vehicle, whatever it might be. So it's tricky.
The software sounds incredibly complicated, but for me, the hardware as well is quite important. The way we see robots normally is as machines that can be mobile, can actually get around the place to do tasks, to work out things for themselves. And just if you take the example, say, of a robot vacuum cleaner, at the moment they're pretty useless. They can do a flat surface reasonably well, but they can't negotiate even one step down.
You know, no.
they tend to break.
And then if we look at so if you think of the most state-of-the-art humanoid robots, so that's robots that are loosely yeah. based on humans, so generally things with two legs
yeah.
or things that represent legs. We think of things like Honda's Asimo is sort of the state of the art. There's been various iterations of Asimo. But then if you look on the internet, there are plenty of videos of Asimo really struggling to climb up a step of stairs.
Yeah.
And that's a multi-million pound robot. So yes, we're a long way off having that sort of dexterity of a human or an animal in the actuators used in robots. Some companies are doing getting really far and advancing that. So if we look at Boston Dynamics,
yeah.
Which is a big American robotics company, they several years ago, they made a robot called Big Dog, which yes. is quite famous on YouTube videos.
Yeah. There's
pictures of it walking on ice and doing what looks like a very natural, very similar to how an animal might correct itself if it starts slipping on ice. Yeah. The robot can do that. There's pictures of people actually kicking it and it still manages to stay on its feet, and they've obviously gone on from there and made some other very interesting kinematic robots. So they've made like a cheetah and things that can jump very high.
Yeah.
But their robots are very much sort of advancing the kinematic side, so they're getting this movement really good. But what they perhaps haven't done so much is work on the sensory side and the compute side. So essentially,
right.
they've got relatively simple robots in terms of what they can do brain wise, other than stay on their feet and move about fast.
I saw a video on YouTube of a dog robot being used in Japan to shoo people out of a park during the COVID, the early stages of the epidemic. And basically what it was doing was identifying people, walking up to them and then playing a recorded announcement that they had to go and so on. But it was it was very mobile and it was very steady on its feet, and it could deal with the terrain in a town park, which was quite hilly.
You see all those videos of what as well of delivery robots, especially in America, robots delivering Amazon parcels, groceries. I mean, is that something that you feel like could happen in the UK, James?
There's a lot of people looking at what we call the last mile. So yeah, basically moving things between two locations, or it's certainly something we're looking at in the this new building that we've built at the University of York. We're planning on having robots that can both move about within the building, between locations within the building, so outside of the individual laboratories, but through the building interacting with humans. And then on a longer term, we're planning to expand that so that the robots can move outside, go between various buildings on the department, delivering things, or perhaps escorting people, and also eventually looking at also getting drones, so UAVs and manned aerial vehicles, doing the same thing, moving between buildings on campus, perhaps delivering things or observing things. But yeah, it's obvious, it's highly dependent on where you are as well, because if we're in a very modern city, that could probably be designed from the ground up to really accommodate autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
Having autonomous vehicles like that work in a historic city might be a lot more challenging, where, you know, the infrastructure isn't there for autonomous vehicles.
Right.
Or that there may be other challenges that are really tricky to sort of retrofit into this, getting robots to work with them.
At what point, James, do you think we'll actually get the robot of my dreams, which is a robot that can actually make a good cup of tea and then bring it to you?
A lot would depend on how good your good cup of tea is. There are obviously, we've got things now that, I don't know if you've seen, there are robots, for example, there are cocktail bars run by robots.
Oh,
yes,
wow.
I've seen that, yeah.
So things like the robotic hand side of things, we're getting quite good at. You know, we can make a quite an advanced multi-degree of freedom actuator that actually can get itself in more positions than the human arm can. The last bit at the end, the hand, is actually really tricky, because obviously what we can make things with lots of actuators, so we can basically recreate all the joints and the bones that you would have in a hand, but getting the feedback's much trickier. So what we can't perhaps do as well is have all that sensory information we get from the nerves in the hand. We can effectively make a robotic sensor that is like a nerve, so a touch sensor, but what we struggle to do is pack millions of them into a robotic hand. And where we do make things like robotic hands that have got thousands of these sensors in, they also begin to cost an awful lot of money, because obviously it's complicated and it's not made en masse. So, you know, I've seen a robot hand that costs £250,000, for example.
Goodness.
Then it would be very hard to expect people to have one of these in their home. So that's probably where we're going to be, quite a distance from that. So And I think for something like making a cup of tea, there are some bits where you do probably need that extra tactile information. Picking up a tea bag is probably really quite challenging, perhaps more so than, say, making a dispenser that would put some coffee granules into a cup, because obviously that's just something where we can open and close a valve. Actually having that fine motor skill to be able to pick up a tea bag, bit trickier. So I think a few years, and I think it might be very expensive initially. What's not, I guess, immediately clear is I don't personally think in my lifetime we will have humanoid robots in our house. I think we will have a lot of autonomous things in our house
that
perhaps do things like make cups of tea, but I'm not sure they will be humanoid in form.
Is that not one of the major points about robotics, though, James, that we sometimes anthropomorphize the robots too much, and we should really be thinking about robots as special machines rather than human looking machines?
I think it's a very strong argument that we do, yes. But I suppose sometimes having human qualities in the robot do make it much more amenable for human-computer interaction. If I give an example of some of the robots we have here, one of the robots that we've always found works well with wide groups of people is a robot called the Now Robot. That's NAO, which was made by Aldebaran, and it's now SoftBank Robotics. And this is a small humanoid robot, so it's about 50 centimeters, 2 foot high, and it has, I think the best way to describe it would be almost an anime face, rather than having rather than having really human features. It has things that look like eyes, but they're big. Got a ring of lights around it, and they're big. They've got a big pupil, and they've got a smiley face. Yeah. But they don't look human, but they also, you can tell that you know they're trying to mimic. Oh, well, this is my ears. This is my eyes. This is my mouth.
Yeah.
The now has a bigger brother called the Pepper Robot, which is slightly more humanoid in form, except it doesn't have legs. It's got wheels instead.
But okay.
As far as the face goes, it's a little bit more human. And certainly in my experience, people prefer interacting with the now. They find the Pepper a little bit, they get a little bit concerned by it, a little bit creeped out by it.
Uncanny Valley.
Yeah. And then when you start seeing these robots that really take the humanoid form to that next level, where they're using sort of prosthetic faces with fake skin and stuff like that, people get really, really freaked out by that and don't like interacting with it. Now, the Now robots, they're small, and they certainly can't do many sort of, they're not particularly good for assistive tasks, perhaps, but what they are really good for is people find them really for social tasks. So they've been used in things like hospital environments, in pediatrics, just in some extent, just as a companion to kids. So where you've had perhaps kids in hospital for long term, obviously their parents or the carers can't be with them 24/7. There are some groups where they're basically given them an L robot as company in the hospital for that time. They've done things like place them at the front of where they're training people to use wheelchairs, so perhaps people with severe learning difficulties, things like that. And they're getting to the stage where they need to use a wheelchair, but they have to learn, I guess, how to use it and learn that spatial awareness. There've been experiments where they've put the Now on the front of the robot, sorry, on the front of the wheelchair as an assistant, and the Now can then sort of direct them which way to go and warn them if they're getting too close to a wall, things like that. So
wow. Yeah, that's wonderful.
But again, it's so we've got some human features in there, but we haven't taken it to that nth degree where we're actually trying to make it as a human.